So, it was half term last week. I don't know what arrangements that you had to make in your respective homes these days for half term, but my son...
I just noticed that the children weren't going to school.
So. Legally.
Why are you still up here? Why are you not? Oh, it's half term. Yeah. Well, right on it. I'm all over it.
My son is 13, so he had quite a lot of homework to do over half term. So in the mornings, he would do his homework and talk to his friends and read a book while I did my homework for this and read a book and talked to my friends. And then in the afternoon, Miller Pair a Feast would convene for half-term film club.
Miller.
Right. So we had like
Miller,
a three...
Miller Light.
Three. We had a three... that's me. I'm Miller Light. We had like a 3 o'clock film every day. And so we watched... We did the classic films, because these films aren't on TV so much anymore, right?
Yeah,
so
we
watched The Searchers, mm-hmm. and we watched The Third Man, and we watched The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, and we watched Die Hard with a Vengeance, so all the classics. The one that he enjoyed most that we watched was Casablanca. Now, it's been a few years since I've seen Casablanca.
It's a good movie.
The thing about Casablanca is not only is it a good film, and not only is it a great piece of art, but because it's a great piece of art, we watched it, and I was saying to him, this is really distressingly relevant to the world that we're actually living in right now.
Yeah.
You know, the extent to which it's about the problem of refugees and immigrants and fascism.
There's
and
just elements in the
brilliant
in The Third Man as well, that sort of post-war Europe. You know, you sort of feel that out of all that kind of, you know, Harry Lime kind of gun-running...
Yeah.
I mean, that brilliant scene in the cuckoo clock scene, which was mostly improvised by Wells.
Wells, it is, yeah, that's right.
And, of course, the marvellous soundtrack.
But the film thing was really... It's really great to be watching these things with somebody who, at whatever level you know, one is a propagandist for one's own child, of course, all the time, but at some level you think, oh, will they go for this, will they go for it?
Old movies are, I mean, it's hit and miss. We do a thing where we alternate. So this weekend was Rory's 15th birthday, and he's a massive Japanophile and a huge Hayao Miyazaki film a fan. So he said, we're going to watch one of the early ones. I said, what's it like? Is it good for a Saturday evening? He said, it looks like it might be quite sad. Actually, the title gives it away. Grave of the Fireflies. Holy God. I mean, bleak doesn't even begin to... I mean, it's just... I'm not going to give away any spoilers, but everybody dies. And it was brilliant. But, I mean, God, I'm always curious how far you can push... Kids.
And now on BBC One, the person's Doctor Who, and then Generation Game, and then Saturday Night of the Movies. Yeah.
My Neighbour Totoro, it isn't, is it?
No. Should we?
Let's go.
Hello, and welcome to Backlisted, the podcast that gives new life to old books. You join us as we're all togged up in our finest 18th century finery in a drawing room just off the main ballroom of our sponsors, Unbound. These introductions are getting more and more baroque.
They're getting rococo.
Rococo. The website which brings authors and readers together to create fabulous books. I'm John Mitchinson, the publisher of Unbound.
And I'm Andy Miller, author of The Year of Reading Dangerously. And joining us today is Jonathan Gibbs, a.k.a. at Tiny Camels on Twitter. Yeah. Hello, Jonathan.
Hi there.
Jonathan is an author whose debut novel, Randall, was published in 2014, published by our friends at Galley Beggars. And he also writes for The Guardian and the TLS and lectures in creative and professional writing at St Mary's University in Twickenham.
The book Jonathan's coming to talk to us about is The Snowball, The Snowball, by Bridget Brophy.
And about Bridget Brophy in general. There's so many interesting things to say about her, isn't there?
Another woman from the 20th century
who we perhaps have failed to read.
Hasn't had her full due. Yeah.
We will get on to that in a moment. But first of all, I'm turning to my colleague, as is traditional on these occasions, to say, John, what have you been reading this week?
Well, I've been reading this week. I've been rereading because I got the most delicious thing happened to me this week. The estimable people at Little Toller Books, who are a terrific publishing house based down in the Southwest, who... really totally dominate now the reprints of classic and new, indeed, books about landscape and the countryside, nature, sent me a package of books, including one of the books that I love most in the whole world, which is I know I'm beginning to sound like a bit of a bore about shepherds, but this book is A Shepherd's Life by W.H. Hudson, which I think is my favourite book, kind of natural history monograph of all time. It's a record of one shepherd, but Hudson himself is just this kind of extraordinary protean figure. He was born in Buenos Aires to American parents, so grew up in Argentina on the pampas as a farmer, and came over here in the late 19th century and kind of carved out a living as a sort of a jobbing writer, but spent quite a bit of time, about a bit of his time in Wiltshire and Salisbury Plain. And this book really is the account of his time there. It follows the life of a shepherd, Caleb Borkum, and it's the whole of a shepherd's life, but it's also the people that he knows and that he meets. And I think people who love Hudson, and they include Conrad and D.H. Lawrence, and I think Adam Thorpe, wonderful novelist Ulverton, who wrote the introduction to this Little Toller edition. There's something about him being an outsider which makes it's not tinted with nostalgia in the same way that some of those narratives are. You know, Richard Jefferies was a local boy writing about what was passing. Jefferies, I'll read a tiny little bit in a moment. Jefferies does that, but Hudson does that, but he does it with a kind of a robustness. I mean, the language. I think Conrad said once he writes like grass grows. Well, it's sort of like, you know, you've got to be sympathetic to Conrad. He was writing in his third language by this stage, but couldn't have been easy. But Hudson does have this thing, this amazing kind of. So I'll read you a little passage to get a flavour.
Well,
I mean,
this was published about
1909. Yeah, 1909. So it's the classic. What it is the period, the pre-lapsarian, before the Great War.
Yeah.
But also, the book is full of poverty. It's full of, you know, there are people still alive who remember the riots in the 1830s over enclosures. It's full of pain. It's amazingly open-minded about gypsies. You get very few writers of this time, leaving aside George Borrow and the slightly romantic, but he writes about all the local kind of communities, and he writes amazingly precisely about wildlife. So it's the portrait of a community. It's the portrait of one extraordinary man, quite happy man's life. And it's a sort of you get the tremendous sense. I mean, Hudson went on to was one of the founders of the Back to Nature movement in the 20s, and also the RSPB. So he's kind of an important ecological figure. But really, what's great about him is just a brilliant, brilliant writer. This is a little thing he wrote about the marigold, which gives you a sense of his kind of. He turns a meditation on the marigold into an assault on city life. Okay, how the townsman, town born and bred, regards this flower, I do not know. He is, in spite of all the time I've spent in his company, a comparative stranger to me, the one living creature on the earth who does not greatly interest me. Some overpopulated planet in our system discovered a way to relieve itself by discharging its superfluous millions on our globe. A pale people with hurrying feet and eager, restless minds who live apart in monstrous, crowded camps like wood ants that do not go out to forage for themselves. 6 millions of them crowded together in one camp alone. I have lived in these colonies years and years, never losing the sense of captivity, of exile, ever conscious of my burden, taking no interest in the doings of that innumerable multitude, its manifold interests, its ideals and philosophy, its arts and pleasures. What then does it matter how they regard this common orange flower with a strong smell? For me, it has an atmosphere, a sense or suggestion of something immeasurably remote and very beautiful. An event, a place, a dream perhaps, which has left no distinct image, but only this feeling, unlike all others, imperishable and not to be described except by the one word, marigold.
Oh, that's...
Isn't that good? It's full of that. It's full of it. Anyway, it's...
So that is available, I should say, in the interests of commercial balance, that although that is available in a handsome edition sent to John Free by Little Toller,
yeah.
And introduced by Adam Thorpe, you, listeners, can also acquire this book for free from Project Gutenberg, where it can be downloaded.
Okay. You can.
But Are the next six? What have you
I'm not. I'm not going to do that at all. But it's, you know, it's that thing. Is they're beautiful, beautifully made books. Yeah. They're very good at what they do. But it's that thing of finding. And I think it was probably they were spurred into action by the fact that I talked about the L.P. Jacks book, Mad Shepherds, a few weeks ago.
Mad Shepherds, yeah.
I think it would be fair to say it's a very different kind of book to the book you've been reading this weekend.
Yes. So I have been reading the first novel by the much-praised author George Saunders called Lincoln in the Bardo. And before I say a little bit about the book itself, I want to just tell people how I came to read this book. An early copy was sent to me a few months ago, and I've had it on the pile to read. And I've sort of been looking at it thinking, oh, So this weekend I saw somebody raving about it. Someone I find quite irritating raving about it, and then within hours I saw someone else really slagging it off, who also I find quite annoying. So I thought, okay, I better read this book now. If I don't read this book today, if I don't start reading this book today, by the middle of next week, there'll be enough of a dialogue going about it, which I feel alienated from, that I'll just go, oh, I can't bother with that. You know what I mean? I'm not being whimsical.
It's important to say, it's slightly our rubric, is that because we've both grown up in this industry and have spent our whole lives being sold to and having to sell, and, you know, that... The point of Backlisted was that we were trying to do something that wasn't about that. It was disinterested in the original meaning of the term.
Correct. So I'm sort of trying to... I thought, okay, well, I'll overcome my own... I'll react to my own reactionary nature and try and just pick... I'll pick this up. I'll read the first few pages and I'll see how I get on with it. And what happened, well, quite accurately, was I started reading it and I read it in a day... it's a 320-page novel, albeit fairly some wide spacing in it. And I genuinely, and this is an accurate description, and I hardly ever say this, I couldn't put it down.
Yeah.
I actually couldn't. I couldn't stop reading it. I thought it was so.
And you haven't had that for a while.
No, so magical and so full of life. I'm not going to try and, other than to say what the premise of the book is, which is that it is an account of the death and imagined afterlife of Abraham Lincoln's young son, Willie, told through the voices, again, some factual, some fictional, of people who were there at the time, and the voices of the spirits of people in the graveyard in which Willie is interred. I don't want to talk too much about it, and I don't want to read from it. Mm. And there are two reasons why I don't want to read from it. The first is that I sort of feel this is a book... I think this is going to be a really big book.
Yeah.
And many of you who are listening to this will probably buy this book in a 3-for-2, or you might read it when you go on holiday, or the chances are you're going to encounter this book. And what I want to say to you is me immediately, as quickly as I can, is... ignore people like me blaring on about it and try and just get to the book and read it. What's so wonderful about it is it's actually very hard for me to compare it to other writers or other books because it's not much like other writers or other books. Most books are like other books. Yeah. Reading this, I kind of thought, well, this seems so natural on the page, yet so hard to actually find a resting place for in the kind of cultural setting.
It's interesting.
Funny, it's very moving. To read a novel about an American president right now, right at this minute, seemed very, very stirring, actually.
Had you read any of his stories, Saunders' stories,
No, I had not read any of Saunders' stories before, and we'll come on to that in a minute. The other reason why I didn't want to read anything from Lincoln in the Bardo is there is an audiobook coming of Lincoln in the Bardo, which has a cast of 166 different readers, including... The main trio are played by Nick Offerman, David Sedaris, and George Saunders himself. And Saunders got this brilliant quote when he said to Saunders, I said to Saunders, why didn't you read the whole thing? And he said, well, I can only do three voices. I can do like a working class guy, kind of a woman, and a British guy. so So they've got like, so they've got those main trio, and then they've got Miranda July, they've got Carrie Brownstein, Lena Dunham, Ben Stiller, they've got Jeff Tweedy from Wilco comes in and does one of the voices. They've got Saunders' parents and his wife and his daughter.
You had me at Sidaris.
I mean, so I'm going to read this again on audio.
Great.
Because the audio seems, but okay. So I've said all those things on the way here today. On the train here today, I was reading. I liked this book so much that I immediately went out and bought two more by George Saunders. I was reading his book, 10th of December, his book of stories that won the Folio. And I'm just going to read you this two-paragraph story called Sticks. Mm-hmm. It's a whole story. Okay. If you like this, you will love this novel. Yeah. If you don't like this, try harder. Alienating everyone
Take
listening.
Take it there away.
It's called Sticks. Every year, Thanksgiving night, we flocked out behind Dad as he dragged the Santa suit to the road and draped it over a kind of crucifix he'd built out of metal pole in the yard. Super Bowl week, the pole was dressed in a jersey and Rod's helmet, and Rod had to clear it with Dad if he wanted to take the helmet off. On 4th of July, the pole was Uncle Sam. On Veterans Day, a soldier. On Halloween, a ghost. The pole was Dad's one concession to glee. We were allowed a single Crayola from the box at a time. One Christmas Eve, he shrieked at Kimmy for wasting an apple slice. He hovered over us as we poured ketchup, saying, "Good enough, good enough, good enough." Birthday parties consisted of cupcakes, no ice cream. The first time I brought a date over, she said, "What's with your dad and that pole?" And I sat there blinking. We left home, married, had children of our own, found the seeds of meanness blooming also within us. Dad began dressing the pole with more complexity and less discernible logic. He draped some kind of fur over it on Groundhog Day and lugged out a floodlight to ensure a shadow. When an earthquake struck Chile, he laid the pole on its side and spray painted a rift in the earth. Mom died, and he dressed the pole as death and hung from the crossbar photos of Mom as a baby. Jesus. We'd stop by and find odd talismans from his youth arranged around the base. Army medals, theatre tickets, old sweatshirts, tubes of Mom's makeup. One autumn, he painted the pole bright yellow. He covered it with cotton swabs that winter for warmth and provided offspring by hammering in six crossed sticks around the yard. He ran lengths of string between the pole and the sticks and taped to the string letters of apology, admissions of error, pleas for understanding, all written in a frantic hand on index cards. He painted a sign saying love and hung it from the pole, and another that said forgive. And then he died in the hall with the radio on, and we sold the house to a young couple who yanked out the pole and left it by the road on garbage day.
Brilliant. That's what fiction's for, you know. That's amazing.
In that story, in that two-paragraph story, yep. Which is moving and clever and funny, in my opinion, and all those other things, it's one thing to do that in a short story, quite another thing, as we know, to do it in a novel. But that tone, that mixture of things is what, in my opinion, you find in Lincoln in the Bardo in a kind of unique combination.
Great.
And also, can I just, my final word on Lincoln in the Bardo, the early reviews have started coming in, they're very good. I would like to draw your attention to the review on the AV Club website. I really like the AV Club. And the headline of their review, this is not what you would find in the TLS, but is accurate, is simply, "George Saunders' new novel will blow your fucking mind."
That's pretty good.
So that's my last word on that.
We'll be back in just a sec.
And so, turning from Lincoln in the Bardo of George Saunders, some shepherds, to The Snowball by Brigid Brophy. So we all read this week, right?
Yeah, and it's funny you should say that thing about finding it hard to contextualise Lincoln on the Bardo. I found it very difficult to think of anything that The Snowball was like. I was really trying to think, where has anybody taken one art form and turned it into another in quite the way that this book, it builds up some kind of resonant relationship with Don Giovanni, the opera.
I agree with you, John.
Really interesting to try, and it's very original and very unlike anything else I've been reading for a while. And consequently, it took me a while to sort of settle into its rhythms. But once you do, it is a little, small, perfect book.
I agree. I found it rather, I don't know, I was enjoying it, but I was thinking, okay, well, this seems to be holding me at arm's length. I wonder why.
Yes.
Is it deliberately holding me at arm's length, or am I holding it at arm's length, in fact? Yeah. And actually, I realise that there's a certain...
Artifice
and cold, deliberate coldness to it, absolutely. Right, I would say. Yeah. That actually, I finished reading, I thought, wow, that was really good. Mm. That was really good. And I've thought about it all week. It really stuck in my brain.
Gets in you.
Jonathan, when did you... It was your idea that we...
it's your idea.
It was still your idea. When did you discover... We need to, I feel in this discussion we need to place it in the context of Brophy's life and career, which is why we'll keep coming back to that. Yeah. When did you first encounter this book and or Bridget Brophy?
Well, the first time I encountered Bridget Brophy was probably about 20 years ago, and I picked that book that you have there, Hackenfeller's Elf, Ape in that Virago Modern Classics edition, off a shelf of the flat of my uncle and aunt I was staying with for a weekend, and I read about a quarter of it or something and thought, this is pretty good. And then I didn't think of her again until, I think, about 5 years ago, I saw a different edition of that book in a secondhand shop and liked the cover design, remembered that I'd enjoyed it, picked it off, and read it, and then started getting hold of the other ones. I mean, there's only one of her novels in print, so it is secondhand shops and eBay to get hold of them. I think I read three or four of her other novels over about a year, but I read them more than once. Not all of them, but the ones that I liked more than once. And I think you do need... it helps to come back to them again. I mean, it certainly helps to have some context of her of her life. I mean, I started to get interested in her and looked into the background, and it is fascinating who she was and all the reasons why she might not be quite so high up in our... quite so obvious on our radar compared to other people who are writing at the same time. So her first novel, Hackenfeller's Ape, beat Iris Murdoch's first novel, Under the Net, to the Cheltenham, what was the first novel prize at the Cheltenham Literary Festival.
Did it? I read Hackenfeller's Ape is short, it's like 120 pages. Mm. I read that this week. I have to say, that's terrific. Mm. I don't think it's better than The Snowball.
No.
But it's more... approachable, I think.
Yeah,
wouldn't you
definitely.
Say?
Yeah,
it's sort of it's funny. It's more of a romp, I think, than The Snowball.
I mean, I know nothing about opera. I like going to the opera occasionally, and I just feel that a book like this on a second or third reading. I mean, it's so simple. It's set at a costume ball at this rich couple's house.
An 18th century costume ball. So
everyone's wearing, the women are wearing, there's a brilliant line about the women having huge wigs, and it's the first time it's difficult to see the men because the men are all in flat shoes and the women have all got the high wigs. And it starts at about 10 to 12 when they're getting ready for Auld Lang Syne.
Yeah.
And the costume ball is going to end at 8. And it's basically the story, I mean, there's the blurb will say, we'll read it in a sec. As far as I'm concerned, it's the story of a seduction. There's the main character, Anna, who's come as Donna Anna from Don Giovanni. And by the way, how much chutzpah have you got to have to quote yourself?
I was going to say that. Could we just say for people that could you just read the epigraph of the book?
So the epigraph to The Snowball by Bridget Brophy is this: that most fascinating subject for gossip, whether when the opera opens Don Giovanni has seduced or has just failed to seduce Donna Anna, will no doubt go on being debated for another two centuries. Bridget Brophy, Mozart the dramatist, footnote. I mean how...
Your epigraph is a footnote from one of your other books.
And it is absolutely... I mean, that in Embryo is the book. It is about, what happened. It's a fictional exploration of another work of art, which is the opera.
Yes.
And while that might it sound incredibly dry and academic, it's absolutely none of those things. It's It's a very erotic novel.
Yeah, yeah, it's a novel about three... I was going to say, it's a novel about three things, right? Yeah. Sex, death, and Mozart.
Yeah,
but which one of the other British Brophy novels, right?
Which I think were her interests, and also Anna, the main character in the book, says at one point, where she said, I'm interested in Mozart and sex, and she said, well, I'm interested in Mozart, sex, and death.
Yeah, I mean, it's very erotic as long as you find intelligence a turn-on.
Yeah. Well, I've got a couple. There's a couple. We'll get into that more in a minute. But
it's also, you said, Jonathan, it's a book about a seduction. It's actually a book about three seductions, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes.
It's, and three sexual relationships contrasted with one another at different points in that sexual relationship.
Exactly,
three kind of archetypal, the teenage love, middle-aged love, tum-tum and tom-tom.
Indeed.
And sort of grand kind of amour-fou... Yeah. You know, that sort of, what's it called, coup de théâtre, where they come together and... No,
coup de foudre.
Coup de foudre, that's the one, coup de foudre.
But could be a coup de théâtre, of course.
It is distanced, and so it is hugely, you know, there's a lot of passion there, but they also hold each other very coldly at a distance. It proceeds very slowly, that seduction.
And it appears to be off the cards for quite a considerable chunk of the book.
Yeah.
I mean, it's also, there's the teenage bit, which is, I think, really well done, but through the brilliant device of having a precocious 15-year-old girl writing her diary, absenting herself from the adults' party and writing her diary. The diary which she says she wants to record everything just as it happens, which, you know, as they say, with hilarious consequences later in the book.
I will be reading from those hilarious consequences in a short while.
You're going for the...
Shall I read the blurb now?
Yes.
And then maybe, if I read the blurb, and then maybe, Jonathan, you could read a little bit. That would be great. So this blurb is from a paperback edition published by Cardinal, who were part of Sphere, the Picador bit of Sphere.
Yeah.
This was published in 1990. This is the... Here is the blurb. Wealthy, seal-like, and much married Anne is giving a glittering New Year's Eve costume ball. The theme is the 18th century, in keeping with her elegant house, and she is swathed in gold lamé, a solid gold orb, to represent the queen whose name she shares. Her best friend Anna, and there's a bit of chutzpah calling two of your main characters Anne and Anna, who prefers perfection to life and is obsessed by Mozart, sex, and death, is dressed as Donna Anna from the opera Don Giovanni. Within the shimmering, faded opulence of the great rooms, an elaborate sequence of events gracefully unfolds. Anna spies a masked man in black, Don Giovanni, the heartless and impious seducer who did, or did he, seduce Donna Anna. Ruth, a young Jewish girl dressed as Cherubino, sees all and frequently escapes to write it in her frenzied diary, yet she still looks an unlikely candidate for divesting a young Casanova of his virginity. Upstairs, an act of, quote, perfect bad taste, unquote, is foiled by an act of huge and exotic normality in the warmth of a white boudoir. Yet there is a strain, as constant as the falling snow outside, of unease beneath the glitter.
What a great blurb.
Yeah.
I think that's a really good
blurb.
That's a
brilliant blurb.
Well done, the Cardinal Marketing Department. And then there's a quote from Iris Murdoch here. I'll just read this quote. It says, very beautiful, brief and taken altogether or line by line, exquisitely decorated. What a pleasure it is to come upon a novel which so palpably enjoys itself. Not only the reader, but the characters savour the deliciousness of the world that surrounds them. Superb, sheer artistic insolence. And that review is in no way compromised by the knowledge that Iris Murdoch was in that at the time she wrote it, in a relationship with Bridget Brophy.
I wonder where that comes. Suddenly made me think of The Black Prince, which is Murdoch's own kind of fictional kind of attempt to rewrite Hamlet.
Yeah, I mean, because I think less
successfully than Richard Brophy does with Don Giovanni.
Brophy got off to a quicker start than Murdoch, but by this stage, Murdoch was well ahead of her in terms of success and acclaim.
Matt was saying to me earlier, you know, do you think you have to know the opera to enjoy the book? I have to say, this is the second novel I've read in the last year based on Don Giovanni.
Really? What was the other one?
The other one is After the Death of Don Juan by Sylvia Townsend Warner, is a book about sex, death, and the Spanish Civil War, rather than sex, death, and Mozart. But I know nothing. I know nothing about Don Giovanni, and I would say, my own experience, Matt, is no, you don't. I think you don't have to know. And by the end of either of those books, you'll know a lot more about Don Giovanni than you did at the beginning. Yeah. So, what do you think?
No, I don't think so. I think I got more out of it. I mean, she drove me to listen to Mozart, Bridget Brophy did.
Right.
And, you know, you have to, you can't listen to opera while you're doing the washing up. I mean, you can once you know it. You have to invest in listening to opera. You have to invest money if you want to go and see it. Mm. But you have to invest time, and you have to have the libretto, and you have to have the translation of the libretto. There's no point just saying, I'm just going to have it on in the background.
No.
And I think that applies to Bridget Brophy's books as well. The more close attention you pay to it, the more reward you'll get.
I mean, I don't think it's essential to know the opera, but if you do know it, it's the dark Mozart opera. It's the kind of the one that isn't Mozartian, if what Mozartian means is lovely tunes and kind of happy endings. It's powerful, and it's Don Giovanni gets taken off to hell. It's pretty powerful, and the music's darker, much more darker.
So to go back to that question, I agree with you. I mean, the thing is, what you're talking about there, Jonathan, very interesting. It's of course true. It's not. How can I put this? One doesn't have books on in the background, I suppose one has audio books. But one of the things with Brophy, and I think the book we discussed on the last episode, The Horse's Mouth by Joyce Carey, which I know, Jonathan, you're a big fan of
that book.
You won't be carried along by it. You need to lean into it and engage with it. And
was it Max that said, slip down like a lozenge? Was that his line? You know, you try and treat this book like that, you'll choke.
No, you've got to pay attention, because a lot of it is very, very sharply observed dialogue between two highly intelligent people who do not reveal their identities to one another. It's a sort of just again that formal thing, brilliantly done. You don't learn anything much about the characters' actual lives, but you learn what they think about the things that matter most to them, which is sex.
And there's a 2-page description of a woman making her face up.
Isn't that extraordinary?
2-page description of a woman looking at a little wooden statue of Cupid.
Yeah.
And
that's incredible.
A 2-page description and sort of analysing it and picking it apart. And you've got to pay close attention to those bits.
You must read some now.
Okay, I'd love
please,
to.
Please,
I'm going to have a go at some of the dialogue. I'm not an actor.
Yeah.
So this is Don Giovanni and Anna are up in the minstrel's gallery while there's the big stuff going on down in the main room, and they're hidden behind a curtain and they're whispering. And there are some other bits from the younger couple interspersed, which I'm not going to bother with. Actually, said Don Giovanni, as though it took him an effort to speak, I like Siamese cats rather better than the ordinary kind. I like you, Anna said, without any emphasis or expression at all. Don Giovanni made no reply to what she had said, but after a little she discerned that he was peering through the dimness towards her, towards the place at the rise of her breasts, where a little more to the left and to the right she had stuck a beauty spot. I like your beauty spot, he said. I've liked it all night. I like you, she repeated, in the same way as before. Yet the curious thing is, he said, that although I like it, I want to take it off. Anna said, that's one of the things I prefer to do for myself. All right, then do. She looked down at her bosom, which in the dimness was a greenish white, the colour of flesh in an old painting on panel. She put her thumbnail under the edge of the beauty spot. Slowly she peeled it off, held out her hand, and let the beauty spot tumble invisibly to the floor. You realise, he said, that you've made me terrified to touch you. Yes, I've been enjoying your terror for some minutes. Are you cruel? He asked. She seemed to be breathless for a moment. My cruelty is very, very delicate, she eventually replied, slowly. That's as though you were going to behead me and promised that no single stroke would be fatal. You just do it with hundreds of little ones. His voice sounded to her extraordinarily loud and deep, but it could not have penetrated the muffling of the curtain, because no one from the ballroom called shush. "I'd rather thought it was you who were going to execute me," she said, with a quiver, possibly a laugh in the sentence. "You wear the executioner's mask." "Perhaps both. Each, each." She did, and said nothing. His head bent forward towards her, as though for the executioner's stroke, and he began very passionately to kiss the place where the beauty spot had been.
It's very good.
It is great. It is great. I mean, it's very smart people seducing one another.
Yeah.
Which is most of the book. And then less smart people, or younger people with different...
In a car.
Well, I just want to read this little bit from that of the younger people in the car. And I don't think there are any spoilers involved in this. And this is worth reading because it's the counterpoint to that very smart, sexy dialogue that you just read, Jonathan. This is a section where I think Ruth dressed as Cherubino and Edward dressed as Casanova have they've had sex in the car, haven't they?
Yeah.
I believe I'm right in saying.
Yeah.
And subsequently they've had a row, and she has kneed him in the groin. So that's what's just happened. Sitting on the running board, Edward became quite numb with cold and knew that, having exaggerated his injury to Ruth, he was now exaggerating it to himself. As a matter of fact, he had been bearing down so hard on her hands that her legs had not had much freedom of manoeuvre, and she had not got in a very forceful blow. Nevertheless, he felt justified in his exaggeration because she might have injured him badly. She was ignorant enough, by which he meant that she needed a lesson. He got up and trudged round in the snow, trying to remember to stamp his feet to warm them up. He didn't stir far from the Blumenbaum's car. It was in his mind that if a policeman should come on him loitering beside the cars of people who did not know him and would not speak up for him, he might be arrested. The back of the Blumenbaum's car rose, and to some height, not quite vertically, but at the staidest of inclines, like the back of a spinster on a bicycle. Edward's own taste preferred cars that crouched low, as though over dropped handlebars. That was what he would have bought if he had had the same amount of money to spend on a car as Rudy Blumenbaum had spent on this. But he did not trust his own taste, and thought that if he had had the money to spend, he would merely have betrayed the shallowness of his taste.
Yeah.
He believed in good and bad taste as absolutes, though not in his own ability to tell them apart. What Rudy had got for his money was not merely luxury, but respectable luxury. The respectability that went with old-fashioned things, with the look of ancien régime. Edward hated and despised Rudy Blumenbaum's car, but would not for the world have forfeited his connection with it. He half hoped a policeman would challenge him. It was a connection to an object Edward could not have acquired, because his taste would not have been elastic enough to let him reach for it. He felt towards the Blumenbaum's car as a young man might to an elderly spinster, distant connection who was tiresome, old-fashioned, and tedious in her insistence on discipline, her hints that young people should be taught to sit up straight by having boards strapped to their backs, and yet invaluable because she had a title. On the staidly sloping back of the car, snow had uncertainly gathered. It might all slide off in a sheet at any moment. It had compiled from the bottom upwards, and at the edges and top, the staid dark green paint was still visible. Taking great care not to dislodge the whole sheet, Edward's finger wrote in the snow, "Jew boy." And then he went, quite happily, back to the ball. First of all, there is some... I would say in that extract there's some fantastic comic writing.
Yeah.
There's some very good intellectual, metaphorical writing. There's also... What I love about Brophy and the books that I've read by Brophy, and this applies to everything that I've read by her... She had teeth.
When she
wanted to bite, she actually bites there really quite hard. I think that's a really terrific piece of writing.
Yeah. I mean, it's there's very little bad writing at all, if any. I mean, all the sentences I think in this book are, you can feel, you know, it's that sort of worked over quality that she does. There's no, nothing slack, nothing loose. And the things that you think are going to be almost the things that are most difficult to do. I just wanted to read just a very short thing, and it does give away the fact that Anna and Don Giovanni have had sex. But if you're going to do sex in a book, this is I think about as good as it gets. And I think these passages were in the 60s were pretty controversial. But this is post-coital, in case you hadn't gathered. Anna lay listening bodily to her after sensations. An intense, deep-buried throbbing shook the lower part of her body. A sobbing might have shaken the upper. Indeed, these throbs seemed to her an exact counterpart, an antonym to sobs. They made an outburst, a shower of pleasure, the opposite of a storm of weeping. In a storm of weeping, there would have been, as in all storms, a wry warmth and happiness, if only for the relief and release. And equally in this most intense, least voluntary, and therefore most death-imaging of pleasures, there was, and also for the release, a wry sadness. Kind of all the themes of the book in one short paragraph. And hard to do that well.
So that's 1964.
Yeah.
1962, you have Flesh, which has also got a lot of sex in it. 1963, in the middle of those two, you've got The Finishing Touch, which is this lesbian, Colette-ish fantasia with the headmistress based on Anthony Blunt.
I read that this week. That's one of the most peculiar books I've ever read. That's not unreasonable, is it?
Yeah, makes Gene Brody look pretty sort of tame.
It's funny, though. It's really funny.
That she can't finish any of her sentences. She says, just bring me the... And
that's right, yeah.
And what I love about the thing that I love about Flesh, there's a bit of sex in Flesh that I love as well. And she writes about sex from a man's point of view. I mean, heterosexual sex from a man's point of view brilliantly. And it came out in 1962. 1962, if you look at it closely, is the year in which On Chesil Beach is set. So I can't remember their names, but that poor couple, if only they'd read Brophy, it all would have been okay, because Flesh is about an experienced woman who marries a man who is a virgin, and she brings him out of himself. It's a reverse Pygmalion. Mm. And if only poor old awful seaside night. It was controversial, but it shows that people were writing... intelligently about sex in the early 60s, not in a sort of Kingsley Amis way, but in a...
She's definitely at this sort of Burgess, Murdoch end of the highly intellectual game-playing.
Yeah.
But as you say, what I like is that there is genuine teeth when she goes for it.
She was also, as we were saying, I want to do the biography in a moment.
Yeah,
I wanted to play a clip of Brophy because she was quite media savvy. She was on TV a lot in the 1960s. There is a clip up on YouTube which we haven't got an excerpt from. I will tell you why in a minute. But there's a clip of Brophy on a panel discussion about marriage with the none more 1960s lineup of Brigid Brophy, Diana Rigg, Kathy McGowan, Adrienne Puster, and Georgia Brown.
Excellent.
The most amazing clip, right? And unfortunately, they are being interviewed by a now disgraced pop star and DJ and pundit who has put the thing on his own YouTube channel. Yeah. So it's up to you, listeners. if you wish to go and listen to it, you can. But also, and Brophy brilliantly, as one of the YouTube comments says, Brigid for the win.
Yeah.
First of all, she's very funny. And so she smokes through the whole thing.
Yeah, great.
You know, but she's very much in that, like we saw, I mentioned B.S. Johnson. She's very much
She was a powerful
public
intellectual. Sort of socialist, public intellectual.
Yeah.
She was, she made the intellectual case for animal rights.
Yeah.
Very strongly. She's vegetarian.
Yeah.
Let me just do the bio, because then we must talk about, again, listeners will understand why, her book, 50 Works of English Literature We Could Do Without. So she was born in London in 1929, the daughter of the novelist John Brophy, educated at St Paul's Girls' School and St Hugh's College, Oxford, from where she was sent down, I believe, I'm right saying that right?
Yeah.
In 1954, she married Michael Levy, who was director of the National Gallery, from 1973 to 1986. He was knighted in 1981, had a daughter, Kate. Hello, Kate. And three grandchildren. In 1984, she developed multiple sclerosis, progressive and disabling affliction, and she died in 1995. Now, most of her novels were written in the 1960s. Mm. They were, well, we've mentioned most of them. The only ones which weren't were The Adventures of God in His Search for the Black Girl in 1973.
Stories, I think.
And Palace, is that Stories?
Yeah.
And Palace Without Chairs in 1978.
I haven't read that yet. Yeah. It's a weird sort of allegory. And also In Transit, which is in print, I think, from Dalkey Archive. And that's a very strange sort of postmodern thing. I don't like it very much. Mm. It would fit into a hundred different literature courses.
And the one that's in print is The King of a Rainy Country,
which is
1956,
yeah.
which I didn't have time to read, but I'm going to read. Yeah, I see lots of people
from
praising
Cedar Camp
that.
Press, another
I mean, it's worth saying I'm definitely going to read more Brophy. I mean, she's too good a writer
She also wrote, as we've been discussing, several incredible range of non-fiction.
Yeah.
She wrote books about Mozart, Aubrey Beardsley, that peculiar book about Furbank as you said, a book about the rights of animals, a guide to public lending rights.
She was instrumental in establishing public lending rights.
I just want to read a bit. Her agent was the late Giles Gordon, who is the agent who founded Curtis Brown, I think I'm right in saying.
I don't know, but I think he might be right.
And he wrote her obituary
the funniest
for the Independent.
Ever about the agent life called "Aren't We Due a Royalty Statement?" Which, if you've never read it, anybody who's ever worked in publishing should read that book.
Well, this is him. This is him writing about her.
Actionably funny.
He said, "Bridget Brophy's achievement as patron saint of public lending rights, PLR, which is the thing that you know, if somebody borrows your book from a library, you get paid for it.
Yeah.
That's thanks to Bridget Brophy.
Yeah.
It's all the more remarkable in that writers rarely have the energy or commitment to do anything but write and grumble about how inadequately they have been paid and published. She motivated and mobilised hundreds of them whilst for a decade withholding her labour as a book author.
Yeah.
She had in certain quarters, no doubt including Whitehall, the reputation of being, quote unquote, difficult. No one who knew this deeply shy, courteous woman well, she raised the level of the thank you letter to a minor art form, ever found her difficult. And no author was more sensitive, considerate and professional in her dealings with her literary agent or with her publishers. But woe betide the editor who tried to rewrite her fastidious, logical, exact prose, change a colon to a semicolon or vice versa, or try to spell show, S-H-O-W, other than show, S-H-E-W, slavish Shavian that Brophy was. Atheist, vegetarian, socialist, novelist and short story writer, humanist, biographer, playwright, Freudian promoter of animals' rights, children's author, tennis fanatic, not least Navratilova, and on television football fancier, most loyal of friends, reverer of Jane Austen, lover of Italy, Mozart adorer, aficionado of the English National Opera but not of the Royal Opera House, disliker of Shakespeare in performance, smoker of cigarettes in a chic holder, painter of her fingernails purple, mother, grandmother, wife, feminist, lover of men and women, Bridget Brophy was above all an intellectual, which British, although she was Irish, authors aren't supposed to be. We mistrust logical, rational thought in our writers, finding it easier to live with instinct, intuition. Brophy was ever the Aristotelian logician. And actually,
that's a brilliant, perfect description, and it completely captures, and it you know slightly makes you wonder why she hasn't lasted better. I mean, it's always we were speculating as we often do: is would she have lasted better had she been a man? Don't know. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what you think.
There's a lot of public intellectuals who are men in from the 60s who haven't
me
really.
That perhaps, her fiction seemed like a byproduct of her profile.
Yeah.
Once the profile had disappeared somewhat, the fiction went the same way.
Yeah. I mean, it is unfashionable fiction.
It's true.
It's so complex, but it's very slight at the same time.
Yeah.
I mean, they're short. It's just set at a party. You know, it's just about a seduction and a couple of seductions. There's not much happens.
If you were going to dislike it, if you were going to dislike it, let me put this, the case, as it were, for the prosecution would be this exchange between Anna and Don Giovanni. Had you ever thought about the milkman? She asked sleepily. Did you know about the place he occupies in our civilization? He's a super parent figure. I can see, Don Giovanni said, that he's a sort of daily Santa Claus. He dates in one's memory, Anna said, from before that awful moment of divorce when one realizes one has to have two parents, one of each sex. That is, he's a man, yet one gets milk from him. That's so absurd, Don Giovanni said. I think it must be true, or else I'm very tired. Looking into the ballroom, Anna distinguished among the promenaders the man who looked like a boiled egg.
Yeah. But yes, she was a devoted Freudian.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's why the book, The Black Ship to Hell, is incredible. She's arguing the minutiae of something that we've all absorbed, the Idiot's Guide to.
And to be honest, she knows that that's funny.
Yes.
She's writing, that's funny dialogue between two people who just had a shag.
Yeah.
Also, they were saying earlier this was made into the Wednesday play on the BBC in 1966. I also found this brilliant. I knew that I liked Brigid Brophy on some instinctive level as a person, and then I worked out why. Because also in that obituary, Charles Gordon used the following phrase: "An urban soul, Brigid Brophy was not enamoured of the countryside."
Yeah, all right.
Oh, yeah,
all
journalism is
the last thing we must talk about. And Jonathan, I know very kindly thought of Brophy partly for this reason, because he knew that I, as the author of a book about 50 books, would appreciate
a bibliomemoir.
Brophy had co-authored a book along with her husband and a man called Charles Osborne called 50 Works of English.
A musicologist and long at the Observer.
Yeah, 50 Works of English, brackets, and American literature we could do without. Now, this book. This book is slightly remarkable in that it goes through, it does exactly what it says on the cover. It goes through 50 great books and pulls no punches about saying what's wrong with them. And before I will read a couple of entries from it, maybe Jonathan, you've got one as well, I assume Brophy wrote this. And I took this as 50 years earlier, a criticism of my own work. and maybe of many people's. She says, "We have been pains to indicate which the blooms are for, whose sake we want to clear the weeds. Indeed, if you will go so far as to actually read our text, you will find that quite a lot of it consists of literary appreciation. In any case, the popular distinction between constructive and destructive criticism is a sentimentality. The mind too weak to perceive in what respects the bad fails is not strong enough to appreciate in what the good succeeds. To be without discrimination is to be unable to praise. The critic who lets you know that he always looks for something to like in works he discusses is not telling you anything about the works or about art. He is merely saying, see what a nice person I am." Right, so,
ouch.
So we take that on the chin and then we turn to, much to my amusement. So there's a bit in The Year of Reading Dangerously where I read Of Human Bondage by Somerset Maugham, and I didn't much enjoy it. And then I read Cakes and Ale by Somerset Maugham, and I really didn't enjoy that. And I tried to express my dislike in fairly moderate and reasonable terms. Notwithstanding that fact, some readers of the book have responded, as indeed Nigel B, if you are listening to this, did, by being slightly disgruntled that I have been mean about Somerset Maugham. And I would say, well, I wasn't that mean about Somerset Maugham. There might be another book I read that I like more. So then I turn to 50 Works of English Literature We Could Do Without to find The Moon and Sixpence by Somerset Maugham. I'm just going to read what she says about Somerset Maugham. Brophy says, "Even those critics who describe the later novels of Maugham as cynical potboiling are likely to be reverent about such early works as Liza of Lambeth, Of Human Bondage, and The Moon and Sixpence. it must be admitted that there are worse popular novelists than Maugham. He himself once proclaimed that he considered his chief function as a novelist was to entertain. The remark has a certain air of defiance. But in a sense, the first, if not necessarily the prime function of a novelist, of any artist, is to entertain. If the poem, painting, play or novel does not immediately engage one's surface interest, then it has failed. Whatever else it may be or not may not be, art is also entertainment. Bad art fails to entertain. Good art does something in addition. Maugham's limitation as an artist is that he is equipped to do no more than entertain, and that, in consequence, he achieves no more than his immediate aim. He is working always at the frontiers of his meagre imagination, and the talents that he undoubtedly possesses are not in themselves sufficient to sustain one's interest in his narrative. The best that can be said of The Moon and Sixpence, and for that matter of Maugham's entire oeuvre, is that it is admirable middle-brow stuff, ideally geared to the demands of the stockbroker who likes to parade his literacy but has no taste for literature.
Whack! Ouch!
I mean, here's the thing. I believe this book, when it was published, as no doubt they wished, provoked quite a few people. It was published in the States.
It's journalism, really.
But here's the thing about it.
I should just say.
Well, and also, there's a fair number of the books that are treated that aren't even really worth dismissing because nobody reads them anymore.
Yeah. But what's so good about it, and is worth saying, you know, I enjoy reading this book and reading bits from those books, not merely because I like being rude about great works of literature, but because they're written because they care.
Yeah, no, it's
you know,
true.
They care enough about.
It reminds me of the famously kind of splenetic introduction to the Guide to World Literature by Martin Seymour Smith, where he takes about four pages to demolish the critical credentials of the current crop of Time Out reviewers. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an entirely ridiculous place to settle scores, but it's a fabulous... I think he says that it's like a football team that goes out onto a field without anybody having informed them of the rules of the game. But it's the same thing. I mean, it's like A.A. Gill at his best. But, I mean, you know, I guess the interesting thing is why Tess of the D'Urbervilles is still taught at schools and is still read. I mean,
whereas many of Brophy's novels are not in print.
I say nothing. I think the point about this book that we're discussing, The Snowball, is that it really ought to be read.
Yeah.
It's crazy that it isn't in one of the classics. It's a 20th century classic, I think.
Yes, I agree. And I think that, based on our discussion, Jonathan, and the other books, it seems to me there's probably a core of novels in the 60s novels which should be treated much more seriously as a body of work.
Again, like Johnson, that idea of six or seven novels, also dealing with sex in a way that it hadn't been dealt with.
Yeah.
Do we? I think we have a tenuous link, don't we?
Yeah. Oh well.
Our guest is providing this.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah.
Okay. I enjoy listening to the podcast, and I wonder if you guys can guess the guests that have graced this kitchen table at Unbound, which have I been in a pop band with?
Well, we tried Linda Grant earlier.
Yeah, we're guessing it wasn't Linda.
One guess each.
John, you go first.
Well, it's true. I mean, the obvious one would be to say Andrew Mayle.
No.
Right. It must be something more unusual, is what I'm thinking.
What instrument did you play?
He played bass guitar.
I reckon that you were in a band with the musician and comedy writer Jason Hazley.
Yeah, and I was at school with him and Joel.
There you go. Were you in the band with him or with both of them? Or were you all in a band together?
We were all in a band together.
Were you?
Well, after a while, Jason wasn't in it anymore. He was by far and away the best musician. But yeah, Joel and I carried on in a band for a couple of years, yeah.
Did you?
Brilliant.
But we rehearsed together.
And what was your sound?
Can I say indie? And that,
yeah.
What were you called?
Oh, my God. They're not going to forgive me this, but we were called, I think in homage to the Soup Dragons, we were called the Carved Wooden Bookends. They're not going to forgive me. If I get a call from a lawyer, you're going to have to edit that bit out.
The Carved Wooden Bookends. Backlisted now has a house band for everybody.
Right, I think that's probably enough. It's a good point to stop. Thanks to Jonathan Gibbs, aka at @tiny_camels, to our producer Matt Hall, and thanks once again to our sponsors Unbound. You can get in touch with us on Twitter, @BacklistedPod, on Facebook, facebook.com/BacklistedPod, and on our page on the Unbound site at unbound.com/backlisted. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with another show in a fortnight. Until then, goodbye from me.
Here's looking at you, kids.
If you prefer to listen to Backlisted without adverts, you can sign up to our Patreon. It's www.patreon.com/backlisted. As well as getting the show early, you get a whole 2 extra episodes of what we call Locklisted, which is Andy, me and Nikki talking about the books, music and films we've enjoyed in the previous fortnight.